So this is class number four, lesson four of the study we're doing entitled I Need Do Nothing, based in large part on chapter 18, section 7 of A Course in Miracles. And we're ready to go.
Good evening. Don't get up.
I'll try to avoid it. So the question that came up before class is related to the text chapter 28, section 1, paragraph 7, actually sentence 8, sentence 9, why was the word cause capitalized there? And I explained that cause, anytime a word is capitalized in the course, that's usually a flag, almost always a flag, that you're dealing with a word that the course is using to substitute for divinity, God, sometimes Jesus, who may be treated somewhat differently in some contexts. But it's a sacred or holy interpretation or meaning of that particular word or phrase. So it's like for Son of God, for example, is always capitalized. That refers to us collectively as a oneness, as the true offspring of creation's projections, of creation by extensions of divine mind. Son of God. So that gets capitalized because it's us. It doesn't refer to the initial, the one Son of God that's usually used there as Jesus in the Christian tradition. So.
Can I add something to that?
And sonship?
Yeah, I use the word the sonship a lot in my writing, and so does the course. Sonship is another name for the Son of God. Just sometimes that they use a shorter form of it. And I tend to try to find gender-inclusive language for things like that. So I think in my book, I substitute the word childship for sonship, just to make the point that it's not just all about males and so forth. Quasar.
Oh, yeah, I would just say that this little cause reminds me of, through the course, they use the term made for your ego.
Yes.
The what your ego has made versus what God has created.
Right.
So that little c is like what the ego has made, because the line is, let not the cause that you would give them now be what it was
right.
that made yeah. them. So that's the ego making.
Yep, doing. I agree with that.
Yeah.
That's a good observation. Last week we talked a bit about the notion of creation versus making, extension versus projection. It's one of the key philosophical ideas on the class there.
Projection versus what?
Projection versus extension, we talked about last week in Pesach. So this is the good time to continue then. If anybody else has any comments they'd like to share based on their experience last week here, questions that came up afterwards, something that came up during the week, miracles that you want to share, whatever, we can take a few minutes to do that at the beginning. So open floor. Remember, we're recording, so don't share anything that's too personal. You don't want the rest of the world to know. Nobody has anything to add this week. That's fine. Happens. So this week we're on paragraph 4 of the chapter we're doing on I Need Do Nothing. Well, let me restate that. I need do nothing. The emphasis, as we said before, is on the word need, not on the word do or on nothing. And this week we're looking at paragraph 4, which is a long paragraph, but fortunately one of the easier ones to dissect in this section. So what I'd like to do is I'm going to read the section to you, or that paragraph to you, and then we'll go back and take it apart into its component pieces. It actually breaks into three basic structures. It is impossible to accept the holy instant without reservation, unless, just for an instant, you are willing to see no past or future. You cannot prepare for it without placing it in the future. Release is given you the instant you desire it. Many have spent a lifetime in preparation and have indeed achieved their instance of success. This course does not attempt to teach more than they learned in time, but it does aim at saving time. You may be attempting to follow a very long road to the goal that you've accepted. It is extremely difficult to reach at one moment by fighting against sin. Enormous effort is expended in the attempt to make holy what is hated and despised. Nor is a lifetime of contemplation and long periods of meditation aimed at detachment from the body necessary. All such attempts will ultimately succeed because of their purpose. Yet the means are tedious and very time-consuming, for all of them look to the future for release from a state of present unworthiness and inadequacy. So let me break this down into three basic teachings that come out of this and the groupings. This is one of the clearest in terms of structure and flow paragraphs in the course. The first three sentences contain the basic teaching that the holy instant is always instantly available. And therefore, preparation is not only unnecessary, it's impossible. You can't prepare for something that is immediately available to you. How do you, if it's sitting right here, it's like, I'm going to prepare to talk. I just did. I'm going to prepare to have a thought. I just did. So there isn't any notion in which you can prepare for something that is instantly and immediately in the now moment accessible and available to you. So the preparation that we do, as it says in the book, in the second sentence, you can't prepare for it without placing it in the future. The very act of preparation places whatever it is you're preparing for in your future time. The second group of sentences is sentences 4 and 5. And in 4 and 5, the basic teaching is you can get there other ways. The Course doesn't say this is the only way to get to this atonement, this holy instant, whatever word or phrase you want to use there. But time will always be an obstacle. So you can get there other ways, but time will always be an obstacle for you. And this course is designed, let me back off, this course helps you reduce or remove that obstacle.
Time.
So it either shortens the time or it removes the notion and necessity of time by its teachings about how one achieves this holy instant and at one moment. And the rest of the paragraph, 6 through 12, is talking now to you personally and specifically about your chosen path prior to choosing this one, assuming you have chosen this one, and assuming you had a prior path. If you didn't either have a prior path, if this is your first spiritual path experience, or if you haven't chosen this one yet, this material may not be directly applicable, but the concepts are useful. You may have previously chosen a long, arduous path to your goal. If you stay on that path, you will succeed because the goal is in alignment with divine mind consciousness. That's what it means when it says because it'll achieve, it will automatically guaranteed to be achieved because of its purpose. Its purpose is in alignment with the divine purpose of divine mind consciousness, which is the ultimate reunion, regathering, re-recognition of oneness and the at one moment elevation of all of us back into our natural divine eternal state. It'll just be very efficient in terms of time on this plane, because returning back to the beginning of the paragraph now, preparation is unnecessary and impossible. So it's a really clear flow and an argument that begins with the teaching that preparation is unnecessary and impossible and ends by pointing out that since that's the case, the stuff that goes in between is logically, therefore, true. And that, we could stop there, and you would know everything you need to know about this subject for tonight, but of course I'm not going to shut up at that point. I'm just going to carry on in more detail.
Well, Ted? It's rather like the motion that, yes, I'm prepared to die, but not quite now.
Yes.
And I need some time to prepare to die. You're always going to do that.
Correct. And you can put whatever you want on the other end of that sentence, can't you?
That's ultimate. They're pretty damn close.
Yes. Like, yeah.
They're how do you separate?
Yeah. Very close, right?
So, yeah. I don't want that time compressed.
Well, and see, that is your ego decision that prevents you from achieving the holy instant or at one moment in this now moment. And it's okay for you to do that. That's not a judgment. It simply asks you to recognize that you are choosing to delay in terms of the time that we experience in this space-time we've created for ourselves here. You've chosen to delay the ultimate experience that you know you feel when you do have a holy instant moment.
Right.
And it's up to you to do that.
Yeah.
Everybody gets to make that choice.
I'm trying to say, he can't see
holy instance, if time if time is involved, it delays the holy instance.
Right.
And did you just say that, and I just am like...
Yeah, that's basically what I said. Yeah, that we're out to achieve the holy instant moments, and as I said before, you know, if our goal have more and more of them that last longer and longer with shorter brief periods between them until that's all we're living. That's where we're trying to get. Mm-hmm. So when we make decisions that we're not going to allow the holy instant to be in the now moment, which is the only place it can be, then the point I was making was that that's not a wrong. That's not a bad choice. That's not something for which you could be condemned or even criticized. It's a conscious decision you've made, and as long as you recognize that you've made this conscious decision and that that decision is delaying your, as Ted points out, on some level, almost your death, at least in some examples of this could be, then you're fine. Your spiritual path is where you want it to be. And nobody else can tell you that that's not where you should be. The Course doesn't say that was a dumb thing to do, or you shouldn't behave that way, or you have to live your life differently. It simply says doing that delays the outcome.
But these holy instances, these sequences, hopefully a sequence of them, they're always outside of time.
Yes.
Now can't be in time.
That's correct.
That's part of the separation
right.
that we've created.
Which is why... The first sentence of this section says it's impossible to accept the holy instant without reservation unless you're willing to see no past or future. Mm-hmm. You only can experience a holy instant when you are really in the now, because that's where they are.
So it's really not experienced in any way by the body, such as a very intense orgasm.
Well,
I mean, that's as now as I can get, you know, or a heart attack.
Right.
The absolute pain.
It isn't necessarily true that there would be no manifestation or experience of the holy instant in the body. The point would be that the holy instant moment and experience transcend the body. It's not about the bodily experience, but the bodily experience sometimes is, as we'll learn as we go along with the rest of this chapter, this section, Holy Spirit uses the body as a learning device, because that's how we learn. And one of the things that it will do is associate holy instants with things we characterize then as emotions and joy and all of these kinds of so we get this blissful feeling, because this is a taste of what that feels like when we're back into our divine, eternal, spiritual nature and no longer encumbered by this notion of separation that we've created to make this reality feel more real to us. So, good comments. So, let's talk a little bit about the connection that we just sort of explored briefly there about the connection between holy instants and the eternal now. That's a really critical linkage for you to make. And this continues last week's really in-depth discussion of time and how the Course in Miracles treats time and teaches about time. It's important to keep in mind that the Course's teachings about time are that we need to remember what they are, because if we don't, none of what we're talking about this week makes any sense at all. So I'm going to do a quick kind of review of the highlights of the thing we spent most of last week on. Otherwise, you're going to find out that we're going to be spending most of our time this week talking about saving something that doesn't exist, and that's going to get kind of circular. In the glossary index for A Course in Miracles, the most important definition of time there that we went over last week for the conversation this week applies to level 2. You remember level 2 is this space-time, this place we've created. And it applies to our right-mindedness, our right-minded appearance in that level. And then under that definition in the glossary, what we learned last week is that time is a means of undoing the ego. So when we are in our space-time, but we're in our right-minded approach to space-time, that is, we are focusing on spiritual path behaviors, then when we look at time, time's purpose is the undoing of the ego. Now, what role does time play in undoing the ego, you might ask? The definition in the book, the glossary, continues and says, by forgiving the past. And that's the sort of the turning point of this definition. This is the past we believe happened. that instant in time when we, the Son of God, believed that we could separate ourselves from God and from one another. In fact, it's an interesting thing. You'll find this phraseology through the Course, and I really like it. That instant in time, the Course refers to often as the moment the Son of God forgot to laugh at the idea of separation, which is on its face absurd. If you are a divine, eternal, spiritual being, one with all that is, how do you separate from that?
Pretend.
You can't. So the idea occurs, and we don't know why. That's the one sort of mystery that the Course in Miracles leaves unresponded to. You take it seriously. You don't laugh at it. You know, yeah, right, I'm going to do that. And for that instant, in that instant, separation occurs. And that's the role time plays in undoing the ego. This forgiveness we're talking about, the forgiving the past, takes place through the holy instant, which is the medium in which all miracles occur. What's a miracle? A miracle is a transformative thought, a change of mind. A change of mind, not just a change of an idea. So it is the holy instant becomes the, if you will, the atmosphere, the culture, the milieu in which this transformative thought that is a miracle can occur. And that's what the holy instant's role is, and the holy instant then has a correspondence to our now in this time, because we create that connection, we create that link, because we can understand it that way. Really, if you think about it, the word holy instant that says it doesn't exist except in the eternal now is a nonsense concept. What's an instant? If an instant is zero time, what is it? Instant, the word instant doesn't have a specific time associated with it. You know, when we talk about, I'll be with you in 6 seconds, that's one thing. If I say I'll be right with you, that's something pretty vague. If I say I'll be with you instantly, that's also kind of vague. I mean, instantly could be any time in the fairly immediate future. With some people I've dealt with in my life, instantly didn't even mean that much. But the point is that when we look at the word, the phrase, holy instant, we think about time. It's our bodies, our egos begin to think about, okay, so that's an instant. We get an idea of what an instant is. It's a really fleeting kind of a thing, but it is not zero time. But the Course teaches us that a holy instant takes place out of time, outside of time. So what we're really talking about here is, again, how does the body, does the ego get involved in this process? On level two, where we live and breathe and have our being, why is it that time has any consequence at all? And that's the reason. Because it's the only way we, in a space-time, could understand, even begin to understand, this notion of a holy instant, which gets much more difficult when we get to the final sentence of that definition, which says, when forgiveness is complete, then the world of time will have fulfilled the purpose of the Holy Spirit, and it will simply disappear. And it will be as if it never existed. Yes.
May I ask?
Sure.
So, you just were explaining that the holy instant is a frame of time in our earthling level. But if we're able to let go of that time, it's a flow of energy. Or
well, it's all there is energy.
Yeah.
So, it's always energy. The only question is that Even though the eternal truth teaching is it takes place out of time. And the eternal truth teaching is the reason it takes place out of time is there is no time. But if we didn't have the notion of a holy instant with that concept associated with it that allows us to put it into a time frame that means something to us in this existence, then at this level of existence we would be hopeless and helpless to understand what a holy instant was. Because there'd be no context for it. There'd be no place to put it. So time provides us and Spirit uses that notion of time as a way of helping us learn. And that's what Spirit really does with time and body, or time and space, if you will. is it uses them, it understands them and understands our connection to them well enough to be able to use them without buying into them. And then it uses those to leverage our, so we can get that next step up. It's like you, the Course talks often about this thing called a little willingness. We cannot do the entire step from where we are to divine, eternal, spiritual being recognition at one non-time on our own. God can do it all, but will not until we have said, I'm willing to do that. And that gets back to what Ted was saying a minute ago. You get to a place where you have to be willing to say, it's okay, I'll die, if that's what it is. I'm ready to do that, whatever it is. I'm not preparing for it. I'm not studying it. I'm not thinking about it. I'm ready. In this now moment, let's do it. And then something happens or something doesn't. And that becomes a function not of what we want necessarily, but of how our connection to the whole oneness entity is. And we make some choices, and some things just are there. So Holy Spirit's purpose in this context is clearly is the completion of the forgiveness. And that's the purpose we have to have. That's the purpose to which if we live, then we are facilitating and accelerating in space-time time, in temporal time, the process of atonement or at-one-ment. We're doing that by participating, even though we're participating in a time scheme. We're doing it by understanding that that time scheme is an artificial construct that we're using because it's an easier way for us and the people we want to forgive and bring to salvation or at one moment to understand what's going on and how to explain how to understand that in their own minds. So that's how we define the role of the connection between holy instant and the eternal now from the perspective where we are on this level. When we raise our consciousness up to level one, which is when we are conscious of our true divine nature as eternal spiritual beings, when we are aware of that, then we have a different, then time has a different purpose and a different meaning. Time as we know it doesn't exist. Time and eternity is all at once. It is, as the glossary index says, all contained in a tiny instant. Now, there you go again. An instant is a time. An instant is a time. It's a time function. It's a measurement of time. And yet we're saying time doesn't exist. And again, it's really important to keep in mind that the reason we have that is because without it, we wouldn't have any understanding at all. Once we understand it and we get our heads around it, we can do away with the notion. But until then, you can't. It's like if you don't know what a triangle looks like, somebody describing a triangular piece of something to you doesn't have no place to put it. You couldn't visualize it. But as soon as you've seen one triangle, you understand triangle as a concept. This is a case here where you can't understand eternity. But if I tell you that everything that ever happened or will happen or seems to have happened takes place in one tiny instant, too small to be measured in time, then you'll understand when it becomes necessary for you to deal with eternity what that is. You'll have a better shot at grasping that. Now, that time, that eternity, that one tiny instant has already happened. Has to have by definition, doesn't it? But it can't be in the past because that would be time. So there's only one tiny now instant that's eternity. And everything is happening at the same time or has happened at the same time. When we come into this space-time, we create time primarily as a way, Einstein, great quote from Einstein. Einstein said, the reason we have time is so everything doesn't happen at once. Mm-hmm. Right? And what happens if everything happens at once? We can't do anything with it. Time is the way we judge things like change and growth and progress and process and our own life cycle. I mean, everything in this space-time is a function of dealing with time. You know, we can't escape it. So what the Course is trying to teach us is how to take that understanding of time, as wrong as it is, and compress it down to the point where we can understand a little bit of what this holy instant thing really looks like.
It's like a snapshot.
Yeah, it's like a snapshot that didn't need a flashbulb. Now, this tiny instant we're just talking about is the same one I was talking about a minute ago when we forgot to laugh, when the Son of Man forgot to laugh at the idea of the separation and took it seriously.
I have a, while you were talking, I thought of a visual representation.
Okay.
See what you think. But on here I have, like, say if this paper, which is in two dimensions, is, if there's time in here, and we are outside of time and space, you know, it may appear that, you know, that this is the past back here, this is the future over here. Well, you have a holy instant, it's a pinprick in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
You might say that it happened at this point in your life. If you're over here, it looks like it's past, or maybe it's going to occur. But outside of time and space, all of this is outside of it. So it doesn't make sense in time, but within the system here, it looks like it's only a portion, a small moment in your life. Of course, what's going through it is eternity. We're on both sides. We're on every side.
Every
of
side of it, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, good. I like that. Maybe that helps somebody else get a little better handle on this as well. So, this idea that we forgot to laugh was the mistake. That's the one thing that we talk about forgiving, is forgetting who we really are, which goes back to that one instance. But Spirit has already undone that mistake, which in fact never happened. Because it's impossible. So why do we talk about this incident in time when Son of God forgot to laugh at that idea? Because it's the only way we have in this space-time, in this dimensional reality, of understanding how this could come about. It's the only way to answer the mystery. Every class I teach on A Course in Miracles, we eventually get the question we've had it a couple times here. Why did we separate? If everything was perfect, if we were all one, and there was, and presumably because there's no time, that means there's also no, you know, forgive. There's no forgiveness in that eternity because there's nothing to forgive. And that sounds like a perfect place. Why would we leave it? And in fact, we didn't leave it. What we did was we created a place and a time, a space-time, where that projection of us could enjoy a different kind of an existence for whatever purpose that turns out to be. And we're just actors in a movie, writers of a script, directors of a play, people in the audience, selling the popcorn. We got all the roles. That's all there is. So yeah.
It could be wanting an existence with matter and a different type of energy.
Yeah. As I said last, I think I made this comment last week or the week before, and I want to be careful to point out this is Gospel According to Dan and not Course in Miracles teaching. My belief is that the underlying teaching there of the purpose of our manifestation in this space-time is that spirit, divine mind, is never complete, whole, and perfect. That there is an infinite variety of experiential knowledge, which after all has to be considered part of the wisdom package, and that the only way to get that is to have an experience. And to have an experience, you have to be someplace outside of spirit, because there are physical experiences can't be had when you're in spirit. So that there was a conscious decision made that a place where these rules would apply be created so that spirit could experience what that was like and add it to this vast fund of knowledge that makes it ultimately the oneness that we all want to participate in and be part of.
We used to say that to go see a movie, that what was required was to suspend your disbelief.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what we're doing here. A lot of what we're doing here is, I don't know if we're suspending disbelief so much as it is kind of learning to engage in disbelief, which we typically don't want to do. I mean, we typically don't want to do that. We want everything to look like it is. So to learn to disbelieve that this is a reality, to learn to disbelieve that we're separate, to learn to disbelieve that there's that's harder, I think, than the suspending disbelief, which you can do momentarily. I'm sorry?
I would be wanting to.
Well, it depends on which angle you're
taking. Yeah, where are you in? Or whether you're out here.
I was talking about disbelieving in this time space, learning to disbelieve, learning to convince ourselves that this isn't real.
Right.
Not to believe this as real, is what I was saying. That just is a flip on that same coin toss. So when we first hear of the holy instant, we're almost certainly tempted, but given our nature as space-time creatures, we see it as something that we want, right? I mean, it sounds like a really powerful, positive thing we could have. So we set out to create a plan for getting it. Step one, we always make a plan, right? That's the old saying that the from Jewish tradition. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. Alan Watson, in the book that we're using as a supplemental core text here, says, when we first encounter the concept of a holy instant, our typical way of thinking immediately begins to develop some sort of plan for a quote-unquote achieving it. We perceive this holy instant, as something we do not presently have, but which we wish to attain at some point in the future. We see ourselves at present as lacking in some way, not worthy, not ready. So we embark on a program of preparation. And therein lies the problem. So we prepare, and we prepare, and we prepare. And there's an old saying that life is what happens when you're waiting for life to happen. And this is the same exact model. What happens is you're preparing and preparing and preparing for something you can only have in this now moment instant. This instant now moment. That's it. There's no other place for it. You can't prepare for that. In sentence one of this paragraph we're reading tonight, seeing no past or future takes us back to paragraph three, which we did last week, and the notions of sin, which takes place in the past, guilt, which we feel in the moment, and fear, which is always about the future. That's the realm of the ego, sin, guilt, fear. That's what the ego's world is made up of. And remember that as long as we're stuck in those concepts of sin, guilt, and fear, you can't be in the now. Because there is no sin in the now, and there is nothing to fear in the now. So the very act of deciding to prepare for the holy instant places it in the future, doesn't it? It's like an automatic, there's no other way for it to happen. Now we have said, boy, I really like the idea of a holy instant. I'm going to see how many of those I can capture. What do I have to do that? And then we go read a book, or we go to a class, or we go to meditation, or we think about that, or we write something, or whatever the kinds of processes that we might go through to prepare for that, never engaging in the holy instant, because we're not in the now. It kind of reminds you of like in cartoons where you see an animal who has got a carrot with a stick tied to him, and he's always chasing the carrot. He's never going to catch it because he's in a different time than the carrot. He's in a different space than the carrot. And that's what we do. We put the holy instant in a different time and space from where it is and then wonder why we can't get our hands on it. We're always pursuing it, always preparing for it, never finishing, never accomplishing what it is we set out to do. The holy instant can only be experienced in the now. And now we know there is no time but now, and we can experience no time but now. We know that on level one. We know that when we are conscious of our divine, eternal, spiritual nature. But in this space-time, we cannot find a way to lock into that that makes sense, so we keep sort of bumping up against it. And that's why I described this sort of space-time flow as being one of approaching, having a holy instant moment going away, having some time appear to pass, having another holy instant moment going away, have another holy instant moment appear to occur, etc. That's how our lives work. And what we're trying to do ultimately is get to where we're always in the now, because if we're in the now always, what do we get? One holy instant. Our life is a holy instant then. What is it about ourselves that we think is unworthy or unprepared to experience the holy instant right now? Well, one is the possibility that our ego has convinced us that we have one or more shortcomings. Not smart enough, can't get this whole idea of the eternal now. That's just like, I may be here another 20 years going to this class every night and I wouldn't get that. And your ego mind is telling you, some of you, in this now moment, that you will never understand this now moment. Conceptually, just won't happen. Not smart enough, don't have the words, don't understand what this whole space-time thing he keeps talking about is. Einstein's a fictional character. conflicts with what my mother told me when I was three. There's all sorts of that kind of stuff going on.
Negative self-talk.
Negative self-talk. Another obstacle I think gets in our way that causes us to judge ourselves as unworthy or unprepared is our lack of understanding of the holy instant. We don't even understand what it is. We have them, but we don't identify them. And so what happens is we're sitting here talking to you, and your ego mind is going, "What's he talking about? Holy instant? What is that? I never had one. I mean, even though he's described them, I'm not sure I would know one if it walked up and hit me over the head. I don't have any comprehension. It's just mumbo jumbo." Or like one of my students in one of my workshops said one time to me, said, "Dad, you're a really smart guy, but you're just a snake oil salesman. You're not selling anything I understand how to buy or what I would do with it if I owned it." Another thing that I think we could see ourselves as being unworthy or unprepared is the point that Ted made earlier about I'm just not ready. I understand the notion of a holy instant. I understand that getting there and staying in that now moment is the ultimate goal, the ultimate objective, the purpose I signed up for here. But I got a lot of things I want to do before I do that. So I'm going to put that off. We can do that without guilt, at least conscious guilt, by preparing for it. Well, I'm not really, you know, I'm not. But the Course tells us right here in sentence 3 that we can have a holy instant in any, and by implication, every now moment. And how do we do that? By desiring it. Which then brings up the question, how do you prepare to desire something? There's no way to do it. You either desire it or you don't. You don't prepare for it. Desire is a now moment kind of a feeling, kind of an experience.
It's just there.
Yeah.
You have to have some momentum to get there, so you need your willpower to stay focused.
Nah.
Yeah.
That's ego talking again. That's ego mind, small ego mind talking again. And it's not wrong. It's just level 2 thinking. So I would say to you, yeah, okay, but at the instant that you form the notion that this is something I desire, the desire is formed. And if you don't desire it, then you're not preparing to desire it. You're simply postponing admitting that you desire it because you've already created the desire. If you see something, you know, desire really is a kind of an emotional gut kind of response. You see something you want, you form an instant desire for it. Wall Street Journal, about 15 years ago, did a study with a whole bunch of different gadgets and stuff, and they concluded that the average time for an American to go from something being unnecessary luxury to absolute essential item in his life is about 7 days, on average. Sometimes it's a lot faster, sometimes it's a little slower. But
it's about 7 months.
7 days.
We haven't seen Billy Mays.
They haven't seen some of my desires to buy books and good gadgets either.
Can you counteract it?
Can you counteract a desire? Sure, you can desire something that's incompatible with that. You can stop desiring anytime you'd like. Desire is not compulsive. But if you, what we're talking about here is all it takes to have a holy instant moment is to have the desire for a holy instant moment. And if you don't do that, then and you're preparing for it, you're preparing for something you either already have or you don't have. You either want one of those or you don't. And if you do, preparation is unnecessary. And that's really the driving point here, less than it is about what the emotion of desire might be. But the notion of preparing to desire is irrational. Not that that stops ego, but is a point.
So, Dan, if you said asking, you shall receive, and then you stop asking, is that counteracting what you're wanting?
No, not unless you ask not to receive it. And then you'll get it anyway because the word not doesn't have any value. You could switch your desire to something that would be incompatible with it and make it impossible to receive item A because of item B. You can try to do that, but that's really hard. In my experience, it doesn't work. So, long-winded way of getting through the importance of the definition and the connection between time and holy instance. So we can get to the point of asking the really sort of underlying question behind all this stuff, which is, why do we have time at all? What is its value? Why do we have it? And the answer to that question, and lots of other really interesting questions related to it, is in chapter 15 of the text. Chapter 15, verse chapter 15. Chapter 15, I pointed out last week, this is the chapter that's called The Holy Instant. That gives you a clue that it's probably a lot of information in there about it. And the first section is called The Two Uses of Time. So I'm just going to read a couple of portions from it that I think will help you, and I would encourage you, if this subject continues to interest you, or on the other side of the coin, plague you, and you want to know more about it, this is a good place to go for that, that source. Opening paragraph, opening sentence is one of the most, a couple sentences, one of the most cogent thoughts, I think, in the whole course. Can you imagine what it means to have no cares, no worries, no anxieties, but merely to be perfectly calm and quiet all the time? Yet that is what time is for, to learn just that and nothing more. That's why we have time, because we don't, in this space-time, understand how to get no cares, no worries, blissful, carefree. That's why that state is often referred to as bliss or nirvana. We have to have, because of our construction of this reality, of this space-time, we have to have time to learn that. And that is time's only purpose, is to give us a, if you will, of an interval, a gap, in which to learn this for ourselves. Because we can't be, it's not something somebody else can hand us or give us. We have to learn it. We have to experience it.
We have to learn to let it go.
You have to learn to let it in. You have to learn to let it be seen and experienced.
I don't think I understand this part. I mean, when you first read that, it sounds to me, or it seemed to me that time was what was getting in the way of having no cares, no worries. Mm-hmm. You know, that once you created this space-time continuum and decide to live here, that that's where we're experiencing all these worries and cares. And so I'm
correct. You're going back to the definition. At level two, wrong-mindedness, that description is absolutely correct, because that's ego's way of looking at time.
Okay.
At level two, when I'm in right-mindedness, level two is on this space-time plane. So level one is our thinking as divine, eternal, spiritual beings, mind, and then level two is what we get here. Okay. And level two, we have two different ways we approach things, right-mindedly and wrong-mindedly. This is all from last week's lecture.
And looking at it
from a
paragraph from two wrong-minded is how I'm viewing that?
Right. So you're at level two in this space-time and allowing ego mind, ego thought, to determine, to define this process. And in that, from that perspective, that's correct. If I put on my right mind, if I get into my right mind, I'm still in this space-time. Now my purpose, you know, the purpose of time is to undo the ego. I have a different experience of time and a different understanding of time. Still not right yet. It's still not correct in terms of the eternal scheme of things, but I'm getting closer. And it's in that context that we see time being essential to us learning this stuff. It doesn't happen instantly, as we're experiencing sitting here and having to say some of the same things over and over again, week in and week out, because the Course says them over and over again, week in and week out, because that's how it works. That's how we learn. We need time in which to learn at this level of mind that we are at. And this is where we are. Yes, ego or spirit, but the point is we're not at our divine mind, eternal nature. We're in this space-time. Mm-hmm. Farther down in paragraph two, near the end of the paragraph, the ego, like the Holy Spirit, uses time to convince you of the inevitability of the goal and end of teaching. That's a really important sentence. I'm going to read it again. The ego, like the Holy Spirit, these two things have something in common here, uses time to convince you of the inevitability of the goal and end of teaching. To the ego, though, that goal is death, which is its end. Mm-hmm. To Holy Spirit, the goal is life, which has no end. So those are the two uses of time that it's talking about. Ego uses time to convince us of the reality and finality and inevitability of death. Spirit uses time to teach us that there is no such thing as an end because there's no such thing as time. So it builds the teaching about time on the notion that we understand of time and then demonstrates to us why death and end are not an inevitable part of time by pointing out that time is eternal. So I think those are fairly clear. You may want to go back and read those on your own at some point, because they really do are add something, I think. And let's go to paragraph 9, sentence 5 to the end of that. Take this very instant now and think of it as all there is of time. Nothing can reach you here out of the past. And it is here that you are completely absolved, completely free, and wholly without condemnation. From this holy instant, wherein holiness was born again, you will go forth in time without fear and with no sense of change with time. Because change is what happens in time, isn't it? That's how we measure time. So that was from chapter 15, section 1, paragraph 9, starting with the fifth sentence and to the end of that paragraph. If there's no change, then there's no time. You can't measure it. I'll give you an example of that. If you're held in solitary confinement in a place where you never see the sun, and you never see other people, and there's no regular schedule that you can discern to things, time stops. It has no meaning. There's nothing by which to measure or gauge it. That's a technique that's used in prison and imprisonment, because if you like turn lights on and off at irregular intervals, you can make a person go fairly bonkers, because they're no longer in touch with time and they are space-time beings. And then down on this in the same section in paragraph 11. Near the end of that in sentence 4. It takes far longer to teach you to be willing to give him this. This is the a holy instant, an instant. Give spirit an instant. Than for him, spirit, to use this tiny instant to offer you the whole of heaven. Okay? It takes longer for you to be willing to give spirit an instant than it will take spirit to make all the rest of it happen. Again, it's a contrast between the two perspectives in use of time. Paragraph 14, really interesting. How long is an instant? We've talked about that, you know, can't provide a precise measurement. And the course suggests some ideas, and these are just sort of analogies. An instant is as long as it takes to reestablish perfect sanity, perfect peace, and perfect love for everyone, for God, and for yourself. That's an instant, huh? It's an instant at level one mind, not necessarily at the level we're at here. It's as long as it takes to remember immortality and your immortal creations who share it with you. What do you mean I've got immortal creations? I thought I was created by making things and not creating them, and I do projection and not extension. This is at level one mind again. This is at the point when you are one with divine mind, which is creating by extension, and all of whose creations are by definition immortal, because things can only create after their kind. It is as long as it takes to exchange hell for heaven. Long enough to transcend all of the ego's making and ascend unto your Father. Return to the divine mind. Engage in experience at one-ment. So spirit uses time to teach us who we are. Because in the space-time we've created, we won't understand teaching that doesn't take place within and over time. You've heard me tell my part of my personal story before, where I have this experience in a meditative state where I walk into a room meeting my higher self, and I'm in a monastery, and there's this room full of, as far as I can tell, unlimited numbers of books, manuscripts, and other kinds of media, and I have an instant notion that I have just absorbed and been given and downloaded all that knowledge and wisdom. That's not believable to you. That wasn't believable to me. Some ways it still isn't. But the experience was very real. I can still recreate it. But what I'm pointing out there is that notion of an instant, that kind of an instant, isn't something that we are prepared to identify with as an instant recognition. So we always believe these things have to take place over time. And when anybody talks to us about anything that doesn't take place in the context of time, we tend not to be able to either understand it, appreciate it, or believe it. That's why time travel stories are so hard for us to grapple with. No matter how simplistic the storylines. I don't know if you've seen the new Star Trek movie. If you haven't, you should. Best prequel I ever saw. But it bounces back and forth through time in some very interesting ways. But if you're not paying attention, you can get lost. And even if you are paying attention, you can get confused. So, see you a second time. Time. Now, so we get all this conversation about time. We talk about time. It feels like time is something we have to sort of grapple with or overcome or something. And then the course opens up at paragraph 15, sentence 1, and says, time is your friend. You go, yeah, okay. Threw me another curveball here, but you got to read the rest of the sentence. If you leave it to Holy Spirit to use. In other words, if you don't try to mangle time and wrangle time and manage time and know, understand time and wrestle it into the things you want it to be or do, but release the notion of time and release the need for time to Spirit, then time can become your friend because Spirit can then use time freely without your interference, if you will. Right, let go and let Spirit, let go and let God, let go and let. The sentence 7, the author says, time stands still in his holiness, the Spirit. And time stands still in his holiness and changes not. And so it is no longer time at all. As we said a little bit ago, if there is no change, there's no way of measuring or understanding time. And then one of the really critical sentences in the whole course is the last sentence in section 1 here of chapter 15. Offer the miracle of the holy instant through the Holy Spirit and leave his giving it to you, to him. Therein lies the crux. How do you get the holy instant? How do you achieve forgiveness in your life? By offering it to others. And only by doing that do you get it. If you try to go after and get it yourself and grab it yourself, you're always putting it outside of you. By offering it from you to flow out to, you're accepting its reality within your being and acknowledging the oneness of all of the beings and entities that you share it with. And that is how you ultimately obtain for yourself the recognition, the realization, the awakening of the at-one-ment process.
So give your love through your love.
Always. The Course is very clear that holy instant moments mostly happen with other people. And the Course is very clear that not mostly, but always, all at-one-ment, all atonement, all reunification with all that is, happens to all of us at once, or it happens to none of us at all. And it happens that way because there's only one of us here. So time is not for preparation and process, but for learning and remembering and experiencing. We made the rules. We created this. We got nobody to blame. We can't say that's not fair. We can't say, well, why did God do that way? Because we did it that way, because we are God. And that was our choice. And even if it's sometimes difficult for us to completely understand why it's the way it is, it's never really very hard for us to understand the way it is. There is only now. And so we go, there is only now, because as soon as I finish saying that, now has gone, and I have a new now. But it's always a different now. No, there's only one eternal now. And if you ponder that enough, I don't care what your background and education and so forth are, that idea gets very clear. It's the one thing one of the things the Spirit can really help us understand very clearly, because it's using our concept of time to teach us that basic notion. So how do we know when we are just preparing for the holy instant rather than experiencing it or desiring it? Watson has some really good stuff on that, which I'm going to share with you here. He says, we're preparing for the holy instant and thus putting it off when we try to give it to ourselves. Why is that? Because we need do nothing. We're preparing for the holy instant and thus postponing it whenever we fail to trust in our willingness to receive it. Be unclear about, well, I'm not actually sure I want to experience a holy instant. That's preparation. Postponement. We're preparing for the holy instant and thus refusing to receive it. Refusing to receive it. Whenever we think we're not worthy of having it now. We need do nothing to make ourselves worthy of or ready for the holy instant. We get it by desiring it. We experience it by desiring it. We are trying to prepare ourselves for the holy instant and thus blocking our experience of it in the now whenever we feel that our minds are too soiled, sick, or sinful to experience it. We're trying to prepare for the holy instant and resisting it when we think we have to understand it before we can experience it. Yeah, of course, that mistake is twofold, isn't it? We not only don't have to understand it before we experience it, but it's by its nature experiential. We can't understand it without experiencing it. And finally, we are caught up in preparing for the holy instant and thus delaying our awareness of it whenever we believe experiencing the holy instant is difficult. Since all we have to do to experience the holy instant is to desire it, how hard can that be? Do you have other desires in your life? Are they hard to get interested in? Are they hard to create? Are they hard to experience and generate? I think not. So that concludes the first part of the of this section that we're reading tonight. And I'll pause here for a moment and see if anybody has any questions, burning questions that have occurred to you in the course of this, or if you've just got to, spend more time digesting what's been a fairly concentrated amount of material here.
It's been time.
So do you need time to understand time, which doesn't, never mind. We don't need to be in that conundrum again. You're already there.
Yeah. Would you mind if you can do this briefly, go over this real quick?
I don't think I have time to. I can't do that quickly. But if you want to talk to me after class, okay. I'll be happy to go through it with you and show you some stuff on it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Anybody else want to say or ask anything? So we lost one person just by talking about it. That's okay. The second part of the breakdown of this paragraph that I talked about earlier tonight is the connection between the Course and other spiritual paths. Essentially, what the Course says is there are lots of other ways of going about this. They're not all wrong. In fact, all of them have some value. They just may not be as efficient in terms of space-time, about going about this. And it draws distinctions, I think, between itself as a spiritual path and two other main trunks of spiritual path work. First one is traditional Christianity, which also, though, includes on some level Islam and some other similar kinds of teaching paths. And these are those paths which attempt to reach at-one-ment, which they will usually call salvation, and define it as existing in a place they believe exists in reality called heaven, by the process of fighting against sin. And that's the distinguishing characteristic of this whole trunk then of mostly Western spirituality. So to be a part of one of those spiritual paths, there are some interesting things that have to happen. One is you have to believe in the reality of sin and evil. If you don't believe those are real, then you don't have anything to fight against, and those spiritual paths have nothing to teach you. And then you have to focus on and expend enormous energy struggling against that evil. It becomes the titanic struggle that depicts and epitomizes all of your earthly experiences. Everything that happens to you is a consequence of your good versus the evil force trying to overcome your good and to detract you from your good and distract you from your life. and so forth. So if you spend, if you focus on and expend enormous amounts of energy struggling against evil, what do you get more of? Mm-hmm. Evil, which becomes then a self-fulfilling prophecy, doesn't it? As a person who was a fundamentalist Christian for a number of years, I tell you that that's the constant battle. You never win the battle against sin, because every time you think you've got it conquered, new stuff comes up. And you think that's because there's an evil force out here determined to stop you from being successful, when in point of fact, you're causing it yourself. You're bringing it on yourself by your focus on and belief in its reality. You know, when I became a member of Unity, or a follower of this path, I didn't stop having problems. I didn't stop encountering difficulties, but I began to understand that they weren't coming from outside. I didn't have to go find somebody to blame. I didn't have to spend all of my time struggling against an unseen force that they are taught is as powerful as God. Well, almost. Depends on which branch of these teachings you go to. But for the most part, they believe that there's two powers. There's God, and there is Satan or devil or whatever this evil force is, and Satan or devil or evil force can only be defeated by God and never by us. So we are brought into this existence. Now notice, we didn't come into this existence. We were brought into this existence to spend our entire lives struggling against a force we can't beat. There's an assignment for you. You'll say, okay, we're going to have a football team in this school, and every week we're going to play this school up the street here that's got 15,000 students, seven of whom are former NFL players, and we'll never win, but that's what we're going to do, by gosh. I mean, I'm not signing up for that, and I doubt any of you would either. Other aspects of traditional Christianity in particular that are at issue and differentiate between the Course in Miracles spiritual path and that are, one is that in order to be a traditional Christian, in the sense of being somebody who would be accepted in that group, you have to see yourself as less than and different from God. Don't ever. I mean, my wife got thrown out of a Bible bookstore in Monterey a few years ago for suggesting that God lived in the person that she was talking to, even though that's biblical. Christianity doesn't take it that way. You also have to see yourself as separate from others. Separate from, better than, less than, equal to, whatever, but separate from, for sure. And you have to then, this is the one that really gets me, you have to then believe that salvation is an entirely individual matter. It doesn't matter if the people around you go to heaven or hell, it's entirely up to you, and then it depends on whether it's God's grace or your behavior or whatever other kinds of rules might apply. Whether you go to heaven or hell is all you have control over, and that's the only thing you can do, and so you don't have to worry about all those other people. There's nothing you can do about them. And finally, you have to believe that you only get one lifetime in which to achieve atonement, which results in a philosophical underpinning I call fatalism. Most people who are in Christian religion, in the Christian religion that I knew and taught, believed that you either saved or you're not. There's not much you can do about that. It's got to come by the grace of God, which you can't understand and you don't know how to get, except that it's given to you freely. Except, of course, if you misbehave, then it can be taken away. Unless you're one of those once saved, always saved people, then it doesn't matter how you live. You see the permutations and combinations we go through to get our heads around a concept that just doesn't make sense. It's irrational. But you have to believe that in order to be a practicing Christian. And that's why Christianity has a very specific and very antagonistic view of A Course in Miracles. Back way before I became a student, a seeker on the spiritual path that I'm on now, when I was a member of a fundamentalist church, my wife went to see a chiropractor who was a holistic chiropractor. And this woman, Barbara Phillips in Menlo Park, California, was a really, really good chiropractor. And she was helping my wife in lots of, I mean, really interesting ways. And me too, after a while. I started seeing her as well. We got to be friends with her and her husband, who was her co-practitioner, and they came over to our house for dinner and all that sort of good stuff. One week, I took my wife over to the doctor's office for her appointment, and sitting on the desk out front for the first time that I had seen it was a book on Jesus as a healer. And it was written by someone who came out of the Course in Miracles tradition, and there was a copy of A Course in Miracles sitting next to it. I thought, well, this is pretty interesting. I'm going to read this. So while I was waiting for her to finish her appointment, I sat in the waiting room and I scanned this book and I was horrified. The teachings were completely contradictory to what I'd been taught and been teaching and believing for most of my adult life. I couldn't figure out where they were coming from. They were philosophically come somewhere out in the right wing, probably in the left wing, actually. Mm-hmm. I was on the right at the time, I guess. I went back to our church that night, and I got the pastor, who was a good friend of mine, over to our house, and I asked him the question. You know, these people, they say they're Christians. They have this teachings, that they have books about Jesus, and they say they're Christians, but this doesn't resonate with me. And he said, to find out if someone is a real Christian, you only have to ask one question. And that one question is, do you believe that Jesus Christ was uniquely the Son of God? Mm-hmm. If they cannot answer honestly yes to that question, then they're a cult. End of discussion. And I believe that because, I mean, he was the pastor and he was educated in this stuff and I was learning and teaching under his tutelage. So I instructed my wife not to go back to the chiropractor again, and I never did either. We cut off all of our communication and ties with them because it would be dangerous to put ourselves in a place where the enemy would be able to get us when we were in a non-resistant state, when we were being body massaged and so forth, and we were very relaxed and our guard was down and so forth. So that is a very serious and real filter that goes on that keeps most Christian denominations from even looking at A Course in Miracles. And if you go on the, World Wide Web and do some searching for, like, Course in Miracles Christians, you would be shocked, probably. I wasn't shocked, but I was surprised at the amount of it, at the vitriol that is leveled against people who are students of A Course in Miracles by people who are from traditional Christian church backgrounds. The book is viewed as satanic. It's viewed as definitely a cult. I mean, you can go around there and you can pick up a lot of stuff where, I mean, people are just, somebody will ask a question about it and then just get jumped on by, you know, lots of people in that community about why they've got to stay away from it and what to avoid and how bad it is and so forth. So even though it looks on some level like Course in Miracles is Christian in its roots and its terminology, it's not accepted by any really standard Christian teaching or movement. And the other spiritual path that's contrasted here is the Eastern spiritual traditions, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, etc. There are lots and lots of differences between those schools of thought and spiritual paths, and I don't want to try to get into all of those, but some of the common threads that are important for this discussion tonight is that almost all of these spiritual traditions, if not all of them, focus on, anticipate, suggest, teach, encourage a lifetime of contemplation. That is the sort of idyllic state. You become a monk or a priest or a lifetime practitioner by being a person who contemplates the truth of this for your life. Most of them encourage sustained periods of meditation. And most of them teach that you have to engage in the struggle, not over sin, but to be free of the body. Which, of course, leads you to further integration of the reality of the body, and then you suddenly find yourself going around in circles on that one. More of A Course in Miracles teachings seem to me to be more friendly to Eastern thought than to Christian thought, but they're certainly not directly aligned with either of them. The Course says that it makes an interesting contrast here. It talks about those religious spiritual traditions that struggle against sin as being very difficult and time-consuming and problematic, whereas it talks about the Eastern approaches as not necessary. So it's not... It doesn't have the same kind of level of teaching or concern about that. Which led me to ask the question, so what does the Course teach about meditation? It's mentioned fairly often in the Course, and if you do the workbook and go through lessons, the notion of meditation comes up a lot. But what does the Course teach about meditation? Well, as far as I can find out, the best teaching of this is in the Manual for Teachers in chapter 16. And it advises you there to begin meditating as soon after awaking in the morning as possible and continue until 1 or 2 minutes after you begin to notice or experience difficulty. That's the only specific teaching about meditation technique that I can find in the Course. If you know of others, I'd certainly appreciate hearing about them. Which is really different from the Eastern tradition, which typically places a high premium on meditating for longer periods of time, specifically to become holy through the process of overcoming the struggle and the difficulty. So the longer you stay in meditation after it becomes difficult, the holier you become. Simplistic, but that's a summary kind of a statement there. The common thread that ties Western spirituality, if you will, Christianity, and Eastern spirituality together in this context, in the context of this holy instant, is that they both look to the future for a release from a state of present unworthiness and inadequacy. In other words, they both are having you and teaching you to prepare for this eventuality rather than to realize it in the now moment. And Watson does a really good job of summarizing this whole concept at the very end of this chapter here, and I'm going to share that with you as a way of closing. If the Course is our spiritual path, then adopting its attitude towards other spiritual paths seems appropriate. Now, I guess if you're a Christian and you're looking at other Christian at other spiritual paths, you want to evaluate those spiritual paths, understand them, integrate your knowledge of them in the context of your own beliefs. The Course seems to me to view most spiritual paths this way. It honors them, at least to some degree, and it regards them as sharing its own purpose, this at-one-ment reunification that we talk about all the time. But it urges us not to spend unnecessary time trying to use their means of achieving the goal. And that's where we take up next week in beginning paragraph 5. So the class will end at